all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We're recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. We have three guests today for this interview to talk about Warrior Mission at Ease and the programs at Quantum Leap Farm in Odessa, Florida. We'll start with Myrna Molinari to introduce herself.
Hi, Jim. Thanks. Myrna Molinari. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, certified addictions professional, and I'm advisor at the VA and advocate. And I work closely with combat trauma, military sexual trauma, really any form, and addictions, which go hand in hand.
Okay, and Carla Statz, why don't you introduce yourself to the Veterans Radio listeners?
I'm Carla Statz. I'm a licensed chemical dependency counselor and a master addiction professional, certified trauma therapist. I work at Quantum Leap Farm in Odessa, Florida, with Jenna and Myrna at these retreats.
And Jenna Miller, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thanks, Jim. I'm Jenna Miller. I'm a licensed mental health counselor. I'm EGALA certified. I'm the program director and At Ease co-director at Quantum Leap Farm and part of the WMAE team.
Well, one of the things I have to note, because I don't think I've ever talked to anybody who picked up a BS in animal science in equine studies, Jenna, this has been a passion of yours for your entire adult life. Tell us what Quantum Leap Farms is all about.
Sure, absolutely. So Quantum Leap Farm is a comprehensive equine therapy center. We have been around for 17 years now, and our mission is to help adults and kids with disabilities, special needs, and different disabilities and injuries through equine therapy. So basically we use horses to help them through their recovery or through their injury. And we have several different programs that we run at Quantum Leap Farm. We have Therapy to Friday and Hippotherapy, our At Ease program, and our retreat program, which is the Warrior Mission At Ease.
So this is a located about, it's north of Tampa. I'm not exactly sure where Odessa, Florida is. Tell us a little bit about that and how much acreage you have.
Yeah, absolutely. We have 10 beautiful acres in Odessa, but we're surrounded by a huge preserve. So the setting is just so beautiful and so peaceful. And when people drive out to the farm and get out of their cars, they just take a deep breath and they just tend to relax and feel more more at ease. but we're very grateful to have this little slice of heaven, and I think it really speaks to the therapeutic value of being out in nature and really being able to feel a little more grounded.
So, Myrna, tell me a little bit more about the Warrior Mission At Ease program, which you helped co-founded here. Tell us what its goal is.
We got together a little over a year ago, and all of us had worked other retreat programs, but we really wanted to bring this local to Florida so we'd have more accessibility, and to treat veterans with combat PTSD and military sexual trauma, traumatic brain injury, chronic pain issues, and chronic sleep disorders. And as we talked about it, there was a lot of really good modalities that we wanted to use. Basically, in layman's terms, we wanted to look at what was best going to help our veterans heal, what was going to get them to a place of wellness fast, and really reduce their symptoms so that they weren't struggling so much with their day-to-day life.
And Carla, can you talk to us about how long these sort of at-ease retreats are for veterans and active military members?
We have everyone arrive Thursday evening, and we do our our check-ins and orientation, and then have dinner. And then they're full days, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and half a day Monday. And they return home. We either take them back to the airport or they have their drive home Monday afternoon.
And where do people find Warrior Mission at Ease, this particular retreat? Do they and Myrna, do they need a referral from a primary care physician?
No, they do not, Jim. In order for them to attend the retreat, the only thing they need to do is they can either go to quantumleapfarm.org and there's go under the Warrior Mission at Ease retreat and fill out an application there. Or they can find us on Facebook under Warrior Mission at Ease there. And there's a link at the top of our Facebook page that goes right to the application. They simply fill out the application, and then typically it would be myself calling them back or Carla or Jenna. And we do a phone interview with them and just take a look at what the situation is, how we can be of help, possibly make referrals quicker to get them some additional assistance faster. And then we do talk to their provider only to make sure that, number one, they're a veteran, because we don't accept any civilians on our retreat. Number two, that they have the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress, as that's required for the retreat attendance. And then just to make sure that they're in the right place to get help. So if they're actively having problems with suicidal or homicidal intent or plans, we really work with them and their provider to get them to a higher level of help in the immediate. And then as soon as they are in a place where they are ready to work on it again, then we accept them at the retreat.
So somebody who has a diagnosis of PTS and has been going to counseling, maybe group sessions, what different will they get out of this retreat at the horse farm?
Again, we really look at the treatments that are the most fast-acting, and they're not necessarily the most well-known. So, for example, at our retreats, we have accelerated resolution therapy, which is currently being used on some of the military bases, and they're recognizing that they can actually treat their service men and women and get them right back out in the field instead of having to med board them out. So typically in 1 to 5 sessions, this form of therapy can do what other forms of therapy may never be able to achieve, you know, even with years of treatment. So it's not uncommon for them to have been through years of treatment in, you know, experiencing a variety of different forms of therapy. And they come to our retreat in the first session, they're like, oh my God, like this needs to be everywhere. We're like, yes, yes, it does. So heart is just one of them. We have a variety of other things, the equine therapy, of course, that Carla and Jenna do. We have neurofeedback there. We have craniosacral therapy, which, you know, really helps for energy, pain, and sleep for the veterans. And, again, the setting that they're in and just the whole package really helps them to promote healing.
Myrna, could you give us, our listeners here on Veterans Radio, a little bit more about what accelerated resolution therapy is about?
Sure. I'm actually a trainer for accelerated resolution therapy, and what that form of therapy does that's different from other forms of trauma therapy is it addresses imagery. So if you can imagine, like, the emotional coding is written into the imagery. So if you have fear, guilt, sadness, hurt, pain, whatever it is, any of those, the 5 senses, sight, sound, taste, touch, smell, whatever's going on in that scene that's so traumatizing, it's in the imagery, and the imagery is going to keep triggering all those sensations. So it kind of takes that R-rated movie for violence, and you are erasing it out. You know, after we activate that memory and specifically are looking at it, we erase the imagery out and replace that with a G-rated movie of your choice. So in future, when you think about the event, you're going to have the facts, and you can tell me from, you know, A to Z exactly what happened in that traumatic event. But your mind is going to be playing this G-rated, comforting, soothing movie, and so there's really nothing to trigger to. You don't lose the facts, but you do lose the pain. And you are kind of re-scripting your story. So, you know, if you lost somebody who is, you know, your best buddy in battle, it's not going to change that fact, but it is going to help you re-script how you want to remember them and how you want to honor them moving forward, and make peace with where you are with things.
So one of the interesting things is how this is received by VA personnel. The three of you have had relationships with different VA hospital medical centers, primarily down in the Florida region, West Palm Beach, James A. Haley, Bay Pines. Jenna, how has your program been received by the colleagues you know who are inside the VA system?
I think they're very, we've had longstanding relationships with James Haley and Bay Pines, so they've sort of known Quantum Leap Farm and the reputation and the services that we bring and the quality and the professional setting and professional staff that we bring to all our programs. So I think they really trust us and have that open-minded approach to our alternative therapies that we offer for our veterans and active duty service members. So I think they're open to referring people and realizing that there are other therapies out there that maybe are not necessarily currently mainstream in the VA, but that service members and veterans could really gain a lot from checking out our retreat program. So we've had a lot of good response to it.
That's good. I do think all of us who've been in the, you know, treated by medical health systems realize that not everything works for everybody. So the more tools you have in the toolbox, the better off you are. One of these tools you use, Carla, is the equine therapy. Tell us a little bit more about equine therapy. I see myself riding into the sunset on a, you know, a galloping horse, but I suspect that's not equine therapy.
EGALA, Equine Assisted Growth and Learning Association, is a certifying body internationally, actually, but started here in the U.S., and it certifies a mental health professional and an equine specialist to work as a partnership in the therapy, and Jenna and I are both. We met at an EGALA conference in 2008, and the model is Equine Assisted Psychotherapy, but it's all on the ground. It's not riding. Riding is a whole different relationship with the horse. This is your eyeball to eyeball, ground level, and it's more about the relationship with the horse that mirrors our own behaviors and relationships with people. As prey animals, they're highly attuned to what's going around them, more so than we can be as human beings, and or those who've been in combat and are transitioning back into civilian life, which can seem as foreign as a prey animal to a human being. So they give us honest, immediate feedback, horses do, on whether they trust what's going on or not. And so we're able to just explore that. And a lot of the times we'll project onto the horse what we are feeling ourselves. So that's just good fodder for conversation or checking in with ourselves and what we're putting out there to the outside world that we're trying to build relationships with.
Carla or Jenna, is there a particular type of veteran or military member who is most suitable for equine-assisted psychotherapy? Do I have to have had a background in working with horses or large animals or something? What attributes does the veteran need to bring to this?
None is required. No previous horse experience is required. In fact, we ask them to check it at the gate and start with where they are right now, because that's what matters to the horses. Not where you've been, what your rank is, what your credentials are, but how you're showing up right here, right now. So that's really what matters in any good relationship. How are we showing up?
In Myrna, you mentioned that before somebody's admitted to the program, there's a phone conversation takes place with the applicant and maybe their primary care physician. What role does the spouse or partner play in this sort of determination and therapy?
Family members are very important. And many of the spouses are the ones who actually initiate the referral, because they're the ones online trying to support their family member, trying to find anything that's going to help put their family back together, help their veteran function in a healthier way. So quite often we hear from them first. When I do the interviews, I will offer to the veteran that they can have their significant other on, you know, speakerphone with me, so that, you know, if they have any questions or concerns, I can address that all at the same time and then follow up from there. So family members are critical because, you know, they're going to be at the retreat and healing, but they're also going to go back home to those, you know, those same environments, and we want that to transfer. So in addition to what we're doing, Carla and Jenna do the WOW retreats for the spouses of the veterans, and I'll let them tell you about that piece.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the Women of Warriors retreat or WOW retreat. Jenna, why don't you start and tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Our Women of Warriors retreats started because we saw such a need for the spouses and their caregivers. So we started bringing in spouses, and it wasn't until after our first retreat that we named them WOW retreats, basically because we just kept saying WOW, because these women are so strong and they carry so much on their shoulders. And a lot of times they're so isolated and alone, and there's not always a lot of resources out there for them. So these retreats are Friday through Monday, and we bring them in for peer-to-peer support, education, equine therapy, some time to connect with each other, and some respite. And they leave a different group of women. You know, they come in super heavy, feeling like there's no light at the end of the tunnel, and they really leave with a lot of hope. So it's really amazing to see them and have the honor to work with them.
Well, I think the caregivers often get a little shortchanged in this, and so I always like to hear about programs that are really available for the caregivers. I think VA is beginning to recognize the importance of helping the caregivers, and there are other groups out there, privately funded groups that are now taking caregivers in for a lot of the services as well. So, Carla, how many retreats have you been able to hold at Quantum Leap Farms under the Warrior Mission at Ease retreat program?
Right now, with our funding resources as they are, we're holding them bi-monthly, so every other month. And we started a year ago, so six is probably where we're at. We would like to do one a month, but we're working towards that.
Well, let's step back and talk about funding. If somebody was listening to Veterans Radio and said, this is the kind of thing I want to do, get behind and support, how would they provide some funding support to this program?
That would be wonderful.
Go ahead, Jenna.
As I say, they can go to Quantum Leap Farm and contact us, and they can look into getting in contact with our Director of Development, which is Nancy Crane. They can do that through our website, www.quantumleapfarm.org, or, you know, give us a call as well.
And at this point, having six retreats under your belt and a number of veterans and women of Warrior retreats under your belt. Do you have any particular stories that you think, well, this really, the change here is what we're really trying to achieve?
I can think of one right away. We've had actually two right away. We've had one veteran that came and had all of the things that we look at the retreat: post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, chronic pain issues, a lot of medical issues on top of that. Very beaten up from combat, and through attending our retreats, they've gotten to the point where they are now a peer mentor as part of our program, coming back and working with the veterans coming to the retreats, and, you know, kind of helping guide them and connect them and working with them alongside of us. So they've gone from being a participant in the program to being part of the recovery staff for the program.
And I think that's got to be motivating to the rest of you to see that kind of progression made over time.
Absolutely.
Oh, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
And I think,
you know,
too, this past retreat.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jenna.
No, I was just saying, just this past retreat we had, I think we heard from every single participant that they've gotten more out of this retreat weekend than they had in all the other therapies they had tried. And just physically seeing them coming in from Thursday evening and leaving Monday morning, different set of guys. So, I mean, they had, like, hope, and they were so much lighter, and they were smiling, and they really felt like they had a lot of great tools and toolbox to help them keep moving forward. So just to see that all the time just keeps us motivated just to do more and more.
I got feedback from one of the providers who's a psychiatrist and had been working with one of the veterans that came to the retreat for 3 years and asked me, what did you guys do with him? Because I've never seen him smiling and telling me that he's happy, he's sleeping, he hasn't had any nightmares or flashbacks since the first night. What are you doing? So I explained to her the modalities that we're using, what kind of treatment we're doing, and she was very impressed because she had worked with this guy for 3 years and had not seen that in all that time.
Well, that's a wonderful endorsement. Is this program, though, only available to veterans located in the greater Tampa area, or who can participate in this?
Anybody can participate in our retreats. So as part of our retreat and part of, you know, the funding that we seek, we pay for veterans to fly in from wherever they are. So, again, as long as they meet criteria, they are welcome to come to our program and get the help that they need.
Well, I think that's an incredible opportunity for our Veterans Radio listeners. You all know, family members and friends who this might be the right tool in the toolbox that could help. Again, remind us the best way for people to connect with you, whether it's to consider if it's the right program for their friend or if it might be the right thing that they want to make a charitable contribution to.
We do regular Facebook updates on what we're doing and then also just things on other veteran issues out there just for awareness purposes. So they can always go to our Facebook Warrior Mission at Ease page and review what we're doing, go to the website. They can go to quantumleapfarm.org and check out everything that the farm has going on, including our retreats. There's, you know, explanation of what we do on that as well. And definitely for donors, anybody that's looking to make a difference for our heroes, they should be in contact with Quantum Leap Farm.
Well, I want to thank Myrna, you, Jenna, and Carla for making yourself available to talk about this incredible program on Veterans Radio. I want to thank all who are listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant First Class Paul Smith gave his life to protect his troops. Details after this.
On April 4th, 2003, a call went out for a place to put some Iraqi prisoners. Sergeant First Class Paul Smith volunteered to create a holding pen inside a walled courtyard. Soon, Iraqi soldiers, numbering perhaps 100, opened fire on Smith's position. Smith was accompanied by 16 men. Smith called for a Bradley, a tank-like vehicle with a rapid-fire cannon. It arrived and opened up on the Iraqis. The enemy could not advance so long as the Bradley was in position, but then, in a move that baffled and angered Smith's men, the Bradley left. Smith's men, some of whom were wounded, were suddenly vulnerable. Smith could have justifiably ordered his men to withdraw. Smith rejected that option, thinking that abandoning the courtyard would jeopardize about 100 GIs outside, including medics at an aid station. He manned a 50 caliber machine gun atop an abandoned armored personnel carrier and fought off the Iraqis, going through several boxes of ammunition. As the battle wound down, Smith was hit in the head. He died before he could be evacuated from the scene.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
This is Jim Fossone from VeteransRadio.net, broadcasting from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. We want to thank you for clicking on the download button on today's show. Also, we'd like to thank podbros.com for having this podcast on their website. Head to their page and check out many other great podcasts. Until then, let's take it back to Veterans Radio Podcast.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We're recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. We're really happy today to have on Veterans Radio a distinguished journalist, editor, writer. Carlos Harrison is of Miami, Florida. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and has written more than a dozen books, both in English and in Spanish. Carlos, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Jim. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, you've had a fascinating career. I want to tell our listeners a little bit about it to set up the what you brought to the story, The Ghosts of Hero Street, how one small Mexican-American community gave so much in World War II and Korea. But before you got around to writing that, you've done things all over the world. You've been an international correspondent for Fox News Channel. You've done television, screenplays. Interestingly, you've reported on the invasion of Panama and reported clandestinely from inside Cuba at the start of the mass raft exodus in 1994. You've written a wide variety of books, from cookbooks to self-help books, so you know how to write at all kinds of different audience levels. And I think that's part of what makes, in my opinion, having read The Ghosts of Hero Street, so darn readable. You bring all of that to this effort, and I think you did a great job, Carlos.
Well, thank you very much. It sounds really exciting when you say it, all those different things I've done, so thank you.
Well, I'm sure you got a lot of battle scars from it, but no, it's you can. This is a well-written book that is, well, let's start here. How did you even come up with this idea or this little historical set of facts that launched into this book?
It was actually an offhand comment from one of my dearest friends who at the time happened to be my boss. I was lucky enough to be the second in command at People's Spanish Language Edition, People en Español. And my boss and dear friend who had worked at the Miami Herald earlier, and that's how we had met, he said one day, he goes, "You ever heard of a place called Hero Street?" And I said, "No." He says, "We ought to do a story someday." And a couple of years went by, we did a bunch of other things, and we never got around to doing that. But I started looking into it, and what I was able to find was actually one short People magazine piece from the late 60s, and one short Reader's Digest piece from about the same time. It was about the time it got officially named as Hero Street. And I fell in love with the idea. I just thought, wow, this is really fascinating. But it just never, you know, things never fell in the right place for us to do it for the magazine. And I moved on and was actually working at another publication. I was back in Florida. And I decided one evening, you know, I'm going to start really working on this. And so I started doing some research, found some phone numbers to some of the relatives of some of the men who died, and started the interviews and went out and worked on it. And it really was, you know, I just fell in love with the story. I guess to give the story for people who don't know it very briefly, this is a block and a half long stretch of the United States. It's really just a few miles from where Ronald Reagan was born, right along the Mississippi River. This is a place that in this block and a half long stretch sent more men, because that's what it was, off to fight in a World War II in Korea than any other similar size stretch anywhere in the country. And it actually eventually earned them the name Hero Street, officially recognized by the Department of Defense, and was bestowed upon them. And so this little place, in a place called Silvis, Illinois, it's close to Moline, Illinois, right across the river from Davenport, Iowa. They sent off in total for World War II, 87 men, and in total for all the way actually through Vietnam, 257 kids, boys.
And what's interesting about this, I think our listeners will find, is that at a time when we have a totally volunteer force and a very small fraction of our population serves, this is the exact opposite. This is a small stretch of folks, and realizing it was
families.
A time of war.
It's 22 families lived on this block and a half. And when I say lived, we're talking about a dirt street, rocky, hilly dirt street that they carved themselves out of the woods there, because they ended up getting boxcars from the railroad that they were invited to work on, and that's what they lived in. No electricity, no running water, boxcars. The kids who grew up there remember the snow blowing in through the cracks in the windows, or cracks in the walls between the slats and the boxcars, and getting up in the morning and having to crack the ice on the wash basin so they could splash some water on their faces before they ran off to school. And they had been forced to live there because even though they had been invited by the railroads up from Mexico to come and live and work, because it was at the tail end and then after World War One when they came up, they needed the manual labor. The railroads did. So they brought these families up and brought them right up there. But then people said, they're Mexicans. They can't live with the rest of us. And so they were forced to live where they could. And that's how they settled along this street. And but yet, and this is why, you know, and I've said it a million times, and I really thought of it this way. One of the things I fell in love with the story is because, yeah, we can think of it as, you know, these Mexican families did this and everything else, and it was a different time in history and whatever. But the reality is, to me, it always has been and remains a truly American story. It's a story about people who came here to work hard, to build a better life. And no matter how they were treated, when the time came that the war broke out, they stood up like everyone else and said, this is our home. This is our country. We're willing to fight. We're willing to die for it. And eight of them did. Eight died out of all the ones they sent to fight. And
well,
so,
before we start talking about those who passed and died in the service of the country, let's back up a little bit and talk some more about, because I think it's important to realize this is 1930s, 1940s.
Right.
Life was a lot different then, and the you know, kind of scratching out that they had to do to make their own way, not only through education but finding work and families. Talk to us a little bit about what you learned as you did your research about what it was like back then.
Well, you know, the fact that they didn't have electricity in their boxcars or that they didn't have indoor plumbing sounds shocking to all of us. And obviously it would have been a very rough life, but a whole bunch of the people in the country lived that way too, out on farms all across the Midwest. So that part of their existence, as rough as it may have been, was not that far outside the norm for an awful lot of people. But these were people who, again, it was the end of the Mexican Revolution. And so these were people who their country was war-torn where they were from. They couldn't find work. And the railroads here, as I said, were desperate for manual labor. So they actually went to the border and would invite the people across and then say, yeah, you want a job? They'd say, sure. And they would load them up in Texas on trains and send them all the way up north to keep working on the railroads. And so that's what they did. But scratching out a living for them was, you know, we talk about the victory gardens that people had in the during the war. Well, they had gardens, and remember hobos coming by during the Great Depression and them being nice enough to share with them some of what they had. but they also remember the dark side of being called slurred, being called dirty Mexicans or other things, and actually remember some of the folks I spoke to remember seeing the Ku Klux Klan crosses burning on the hill over their homes to warn them that they were not to step outside certain bounds. They were not allowed to attend the Catholic Church that serviced the rest of their community. So they took two boxcars, put them together, and built their own church, which they named after the patron saint of Mexico, and they called it Our Lady of Guadalupe. And so that's the kind of thing they were growing up in. And basically, sons would follow their fathers. They went off to pick onions from the onion fields over across the river in Iowa in the summer. They would, a lot of them, one of the things that helped them get tougher, but also to keep them in line, was a lot of them fell under the good graces of a basketball coach at the local high school who would get their the basketball shoes that the other players, the wealthier players, or actually the regular kids from the school would throw out. These poor kids would wear those basketball shoes. The other thing was they went to do boxing in what was effectively a PBA kind of thing, a police. It was run by a local cop who taught them to box. And that really kind of came in handy for a lot of them when they went out to fight. They were in tremendous shape when they got to war.
And I can really tell our listeners that as you read the beginning chapters of The Ghosts of Hero Street by Carlos Harrison, you get that sense of community that was because of things like whether it's the basketball or the boxing or the dances or the church services. You get that. You've done a really nice job, I think, of capturing that community that they all shared until the point where they sign up, and now the men get shipped not only through different services, but really all over the world.
And that was, honestly, from a writer's perspective, I couldn't have been handed such a better canvas to paint, because, as you mentioned, all over the world. I mean, they went, Tony Pompa, the first to die, had gone off to the service. He joined what was the Army Air Corps, actually ended up holding the same spot on a bomber that my dad held, which was a tail gunner. And basically because they were a little too tall to be the ball turret gunners, but not so big that they get that they couldn't fit in the cramped space with those twin 50 cal machine guns in the back. And he rode over Italy, and just about 3 weeks after his 19th birthday, was shot down over Aviano, Italy, and crashed, which is actually just a few miles from where I did my service in the Army. So yeah, it was all these things coming together. But that was one I was lucky enough to speak to both a bombardier and a pilot who survived that crash, who were actually with him on board when they were shot down and spent the rest of the war in a German POW camp. But what they described to me helped me. My father passed when I was very young, but it helped me understand a lot about what they had gone through, what my father had gone through, and really to ask myself the question if I could have done it myself. The first day, maybe. The first day, you don't know what's really going to happen. You go up there, you see flak, you see fighters and everything else. Now you come back in a bullet-riddled bomber, flying back, holding, fighting it for 8 hours with no hydraulics to get limp your way back to the base. And in 48 hours, they're going to say, let's get up and do this again.
Well,
I think it would be tough, you know?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And again, one of the things you get from reading your book is because these men went all over the world, you get a glimpse of every one of the theaters, really, from Frank Sandoval, who was in Burma, in the sweltering jungle, to a couple of the guys landed were in Normandy and fought through the bitter cold in Belgium,
the Battle of the Bulge.
Bulge. So we had two of the first paratroopers
in the war, because you've got to remember, in this country we hadn't jumped into combat until World War II, and we had two men who did that, and so Willie Sandoval and Peter Macias. Willie died in what up to that time was the largest aerial assault in the history of warfare, which was Operation Market Garden, which many may remember from a movie called A Bridge Too Far and a book of the similar name that describes how this turned into basically a planning debacle. Left a lot of these men stranded. They didn't get the support that they were expecting, and had to just fight it out until they were out of ammunition and in many cases die. And that's what happened to Willie. And then Peter, in the very next assault, aerial assault, which was the last one of World War II, known as Operation Varsity, he was shot in that one. So I don't know that, looking back, that we can really realize the human toll of the war of this scale, what a world war, and especially with one with the destructive capacity of World War II, what that really meant. But yeah, you're right. And I learned so much as I read about stuff. Willie, prior to Operation Market Garden, was on the beachhead at Anzio, which was, it was just, as I described it, it was just a flat griddle for them to get peppered with aircraft bombing them, strafing them, and then the huge Anzio Annie German rail gun firing howitzers at them. And, it's digging a hole and try to survive. And in the process, paratroopers who were actually not dropped because they didn't want to alert the Germans, but were shipped in like others to land at the beach, paratroopers like Willie Sandoval earned the nickname of the Devils in Baggy Pants, because they were true commandos. They would slip across the lines and the cover of darkness, and very deliberately, Germans were known, and this was found in a German officer's diary, they'd wake up in the morning and find that their foxhole mate had had his throat slit in the night, and they had been left there as just a calling card for them, and the other guy had been left alive just to know and to be able to tell the others what happened. So one of my friends read the book, a young woman read the book, and she said to me after, she goes, "My God, Carlos," she goes, "did everyone fight that fiercely?" And I said, "Only the ones who wanted to live."
Listeners, you're going to love this book, The Ghosts of Hero Street by Carlos Harrison. And part of the vividness of it, I think, is you were able to talk to a lot of, in your research, a lot of individuals who knew the men. Talk to us a little bit about how you painted such a vivid picture.
Well, it took a lot of a ton of research. This book actually took me 5 years of interviews and research, not just the families that were relatives and who were also kind enough to share all of the letters home that these men had written. And this was a time, prior to Facebook and being able to do FaceTime on their computers, that people would write themselves letters. And so I learned an awful lot about what happened there. I also poured through thousands of after action reports, which would allow me to see what was happening in a person's unit at the moment that they were there. And so that would tell me about all the battles and where the fighting was and who died and what happened and who made it, and gave me a lot of color there. And then I was also very lucky, even though, we are losing so many of our World War II veterans that, the youngest are in their 90s now. And so they're dying very quickly. I was lucky enough to find, as I mentioned, among others, the bombardier who was on that plane with Tony Bompa, the pilot, both of whom passed between the time I spoke with them and the time the book came out. And I was the same thing happened to a lieutenant who was with Willie Sandoval or near Willie Sandoval when he was killed. And I talked to people who landed in the same landing craft at Anzio. So, you know, between what they would describe, what I had from the reports, and there's been an awful lot of wonderful histories written about World War II that could give me a sense of what was happening, of where to look for more information, and who to talk to.
This is really more of a personal story of what these men went through as compared to big battle plans and whatnot. And I really appreciated that. And your interviewing and all that work comes through the pages and the what I assume are family photos that are in the book as well. Yeah. Really give you that sense of the community, the individuals as individuals versus just simply part of a cog in a big war machine.
Well, you know, and I'm glad that you say that. Thank you very much for that praise. That, you know, that was kind of a goal. To me, it was always a story about these men who represented this street, which represented these times and represented our country. And so I think, you know, that the story, especially since it then spans the aftermath of World War II and spins off into Korea, which is a totally different kind of conflict with a totally different type of, you know, you basically have a, instead of it being a global conflict, you have a very compact but very brutal, very harsh conditions with a war-weary nation being called upon again to go forth. And yet again, the men at Hero Street stood up, did what they had to do, and one of them won himself a Medal of Honor in the process, going in to fight, because, you know, that was Joe Gomez, and that's what he believed. You know, that you fought and you defended and it would make a difference. And that's the way they had been raised. And so it did give me an opportunity, I think, to learn a lot personally and to be able to share a lot through very personal stories. So, yeah, thank you for that.
This book is published by the Berkeley Publishing Group of Penguin Group. I assume we can find it on all the natural internet outlets.
And the audiobook is wonderful reading. It's not by me. There's a wonderful audiobook. I mean, the guy really who worked on it did a great job, not just with great voice, but also, you know, called me up to double check some facts and, you know, the pronunciations. He actually was using the galley proof for the audio and caught a couple of errors for me. So I was like, well, thanks. I'm glad we got those fixed. So, I mean, very detailed. It's a wonderful reading. And I guess, you know, we should put in a plug. If you like that book, I hope you'll read the next one that's coming out. I've got one that's coming out. As you can tell, I like these little told or unknown stories of from history that can focus on something like this and tell us a larger story. And the next book is called Trained to Kill, and it is about a man who was a simple accountant, a bank executive in Cuba when Fidel Castro took over, who was trained by the CIA and sent to assassinate Fidel on two different occasions. He put together the master plans to kill Fidel. Obviously, he failed. But in that same process, to talk about how history in this country is so, history everywhere is so so weird and quirky, he was introduced to Lee Harvey Oswald 9 weeks before John Kennedy was killed in Dallas. He was introduced to Lee Harvey Oswald by his CIA handler in Dallas. And it stuck in his mind. Obviously, it didn't say anything like, oh,
right,
he's going to kill the president. But as soon as he saw his picture on TV after the assassination, he said, oh, my God.
Yeah. Listeners, I can recommend to you The Ghosts of Hero Street by Carlos Harrison because I've read it and thoroughly enjoyed it. And I want to I look forward to reading Train to Kill in the spring of 2017 when it comes out. Carlos Harrison, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, we want to thank you for your time this afternoon. It's a great book. You did a great job. You've done that. You've done Hero Street proud, and I think you've memorialized a slice of American history that would have otherwise been lost. So you really did a great job. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you for taking this time with me.
Well, I want to thank everyone for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the Internet. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcast and Internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.